Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is The Jackpod, where On Point news analyst Jack Beatty helps us connect history, literature, and politics in a way that brings his unique clarity to the world we live in now. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
Episode 25 today. What's your headline?
The Xanadu Effect.
Now, if you're going to be linking poetry and politics today, Jack, I'm going to be over the moon. So what do we mean by the Xanadu Effect this week?
Indeed. It named after Coleridge's famous poem, you know, beginning in Xanadu, did Kublai Khan a stately pleasure dome decree. The Xanadu effect is a peculiar kind of nemesis to mixed mythologies laid up for presidents who lose touch and come to inhabit their own semi-private worlds. He's looking at you, Donald Trump. But as we're going to see, also most acutely with Joe Biden. In his 1970 book, The Twilight of the Presidency, George Reedy, who was one of LBJ's press secretaries and who saw the Xanadu effect in full operation, wrote, "The most important and least examined problem of the presidency is that of maintaining contact with reality."
Mm-hmm.
He points to the apparatus of hangers-on and sycophants and yes-men who cocoon the presidents, as presidents really become captive to their inner circles. "No one," he writes, "thrusts unpleasant thoughts upon a king unless asked to do so." And the king reference gets at the peculiar nature of the president. He's both the head of government, but also the head of state, the sort of embodiment of USA. And Reedy is droll when he says that it's part of the DNA of courtiers around the president, sort of the collective unconscious, to remember what happened to the messenger who brought Peter the Great the news of the Russian defeat by Sweden at the Battle of Narva. The courtier was strangled by decree of the Tsar. Mm. So that sort of, that fate, even if they don't know the actuality, the sense that you can get into real trouble if you speak truth to power in the White House, that's part of the That's endemic among presidents' courtiers.
Okay, so Jack, can I just jump in here for a second? Because two quick thoughts. Yes, I do want to hear how this applies to the presidency of Joe Biden. But what first pops to mind is, I'm just going to bring it up now, former President Donald Trump, because not only did he deliberately surround himself with family, sycophants, and no one who was willing to, you know, speak truth to power, but anyone who barely dared even whisper of it, he just fired them, right? I mean, he just got rid of them. How many chiefs of staff did he go through at the White House? So this is definitely a common factor taken to a new height with Donald Trump. But, you know, when you said that about the duality of being both head of state and head of government being kind of a unique and potentially dangerous thing here, do you know what that reminded me of, Jack? That reminded me of a show that we did, three and a half years ago now, about 9/11. And we spoke to Kofor Black, right, who was very high up in the CIA just before 9/11 happened. And he told us in excruciating detail how often the intelligence services tried to wake up the Bush administration to an impending attack by al-Qaeda, but nobody wanted to hear it. And so he told us, he said, you know what, this happens with every president. They bring in their already extant biases. They bring those into the Oval Office. And it is the duty of the people around the president to poke holes in those existing biases for the good of the nation. And he kind of was implying, more than anything, it doesn't happen often enough. So with that in mind, I mean, you mentioned LBJ. Are there some examples from presidencies past, Jack?
Sure, there's a litany of life in Xanadu. Harry Truman said he felt, quote, detached and cut off in the White House, which Bill Clinton called the crown jewel of the federal prison system. Ike, you know, there's an anecdote about Ike. He was on the putting green at the White House trying a putt, and a squirrel ran out just as the putt was about to go into the hole and push the ball away, and he said, damn, that squirrel. The next day, he looked out on the lawn, and there was the Secret Service with all these traps rounding up all the squirrels they could find. And Ike said, who the hell ordered this? And, you know, it was, we can't have the president missing a putt because of the squirrel. That was just a ludicrous example of the of Xanadu at work. You know, Ted Sorensen, who was chief aide to President Kennedy, said the day after the inauguration, he noticed a big change. Deference to John F. Kennedy turned to awe in the presence of President Kennedy. And that awe had a mischievous and even tragic effect soon after his inauguration in the Bay of Pigs incident, in which we dispatched these buccaneers to topple the Castro regime in Cuba. Arthur Schlesinger Jr. said, had one advisor opposed the move, Kennedy would have canceled it, canceled the invasion, but not one spoke against it. They all saw that the president wanted one answer, and they gave it to him. In the Cuban Missile Crisis, an even more dramatic illustration. During one meeting, Chester Bowles, who was Undersecretary of State, he gave John Kennedy, the president, a hard time about something he wanted to do. And Bob Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, after the meeting, grabbed Bowles by the lapels and shook him and said, don't you give my brother a hard time. He's trying to make up his mind. There it is. Don't push it. And, of course, LBJ, you mentioned him, famous for his imperial affectations. One of his aides joked, he says, of course I tell the president no. Just the other day, President Johnson asked me if I had any complaints of the job he was doing. No. Famously, you know, when corporal of the Air Force said to Johnson, Mr. President, here's your helicopter, the White House helicopter. He said, son, they're all my helicopters. Oh, God. And there's a possibly apocryphal story of how all this went to LBJ's head when he was talking to Chancellor of Germany, Chancellor Erhard. Chancellor Erhard said, were you born in a log cabin, Mr. President? No, Mr. Chancellor, I wasn't. You're thinking of Lincoln. Pause. I was born in a manger. So okay. That was LBJ at his worst. And, of course, with Nixon, famously, he had this Berlin Wall of Haldeman and Ehrlichman, his aides, who prevented anybody from not only getting into the White House, but getting any information into the White House that they didn't first censor and shape.
Wow. From squirrels being hunted down by the Secret Service to a perhaps apocryphal God complex from LBJ. I mean, Jack, the only perhaps, useful thing I have to add to this week's Jackpod is the following reminder. The president is not king. The president is not king. And in case you didn't hear it the first two times, I'm going to say it again, folks. The president is not king. But so take us to Biden, though, this disconnection from reality. Where do you see that, Jack?
Well, you can see it in Biden. It's particularly noticeable because of the people around him. You go back to, 35 years ago, you can find some of the same people. They have been his liege men and liege women through the vice presidency, through the Senate, on his staff. It's the same group. There are now. You could say, man and boy, man and girl, they've supped at the Biden table, but they also have affection, and they don't want to disturb the fellow, their chief, And they have built around him, I think, a really tight apparatus of if not control. Well, Evan Osnos in his New Yorker profile speaks of the White House, a culture of almost ostentatious calm. That's the reality. That's what they tried to inculcate in the White House. We're not anxious. And there's even been talk from an unnamed White House staffer of Operation Bubble Wrap, in which we'll prevent the president from falling on planes and making foolish statements at the same time. Bubble Wrap, what could recall the Xanadu, the dome of Kublai Khan, better than that? And yet, as with Kublai Khan, you can't keep out reality. Here's reality.
This included maternity kits. This included water purification systems. Allegedly, these were somehow dual-use items, but no reasonable person could conclude that. And when
dual-use items, forgive me, I'll just jump in and explain. Dual-use meaning could also have some kind of military purpose.
Well, that's exactly right. So in no case was it explained why these items were rejected. So you have to speculate. A maternity kit includes this little teeny scalpel sometimes. But when one item on a truck is sent back, like these maternity kits, the entire truck is turned around, has to go back in the line and take weeks to get through.
Okay, so that is Senator Chris Van Hollen. He was on All Things Considered on Monday, speaking with Mary Louise Kelly, as you heard there. And Jack, he's describing the evidence that he saw that Israel is restricting the flow of general aid because of small items, like he said, like scissors in maternity kits. And he visited the Gazan border in January and just told this story to Mary Louise this week. So that's the on-the-ground reality that the senator saw. Take us back to Operation Bubble Wrap regarding, well, supposedly, again, this, but supposedly Operation Bubble Wrap regarding the president.
Well, you know, Senator Van Hollen went on to say, and the next day they sent a letter to the president saying that the Senate should essentially invoke a law that was passed, I guess, under President Clinton that would limit U.S. military aid. It limits U.S. military aid to any country that interferes with U.S. humanitarian aid, which is precisely what Israel is doing in starving the population of Gaza. A fourth of people there, and there are, 2.5 million or something, are, according to the UN, one step removed from actual starvation. And meanwhile, Israel is sending back whole truckloads of food because there's a scalpel in a maternity kit. And what is Biden doing? Well, he's leaking his displeasure with it, but has he picked up the phone and said, let that aid go through, or by God, you won't get another tank shell? No, he's doing a workaround. What's that? He's going to build a pier. We're going to build a pier to Gaza and unload shiploads of food that way. Of course, it's going to take 6 weeks. How many people starve in 6 weeks? And you know what a contrast that makes to the way great leaders have acted in the past. I think of Admiral Nimitz at Pearl Harbor in 1942. They had advance information that the Japanese fleet was coming to Midway Island and looking to attack it and perhaps make a base there. And just then, the Yorktown, a carrier which had been mauled in a battle in the Coral Sea, came limping into Pearl, leaking oil. The admiral put on his hip boots. He went down. They put it up on dry dock. He looked at the hole in it, huge hole in the bottom. And the engineer said, Admiral, this is going to take weeks. It's going to take weeks. He says, you've got 3 days. 5,000 people descended on the Yorktown. Finally, 3 days later, with over 100 civilians still welding, still working on the carrier, it departed Pearl. And it was on station at Midway, and dauntless dive bombers from the Yorktown sank 3 Japanese carriers. That's how great leaders act. When someone says, it'll take 6 weeks, they say, you've got 6 days. Joe, I'm afraid perhaps in that atmosphere of ostentatious calm maintained by his liegemen in the White House, he just said, oh, well, 6 weeks, fine. Mm-hmm.
You know, Jack, I see this slightly differently because I agree with you about the perplexing slowness, right, of the Biden administration's or the president's willingness to act here. But I'm not sure that it's strictly a Xanadu effect because, as you mentioned, he's leaking his displeasure, right? And so it seems pretty clear that he definitely knows the reality on the ground for the people in Gaza right now. But he just doesn't like what it means he might have to do, right? Like, you can accept reality, but not like it. And that,
right.
But that's no excuse, though. I'm just saying that it seems slightly different. But to your
that's
point.
That's a good modulation of the idea, precisely.
Yeah.
But he knows the reality, but just doesn't want to deal with it. And, you know, throughout Biden's career, one of his chronic problems has been delay.
Yeah.
You know, it just goes back to the Senate years, even.
I totally, totally hear you on that, Jack. And, you know, to your point about Nimitz, it's like, well, nobody liked the reality of wartime then, but that doesn't stop the leadership drive to immediate action. And the absence of that with the Biden administration is quite perplexing. But I'm really taken with this Xanadu idea, Jack, so I just got to mention one more thing. Again, Donald Trump is the man who took this effect to its, like, highest highs. Because you remember in the Trump administration, those briefings that were done for him every day where his staff would cut out headlines of articles that would only be pleasing to Trump. And that was in the books that he got every morning. I mean, that's an active construction of an incomplete reality, to put it that way. And now, as we've talked about in the pod, Jack, the Trump and his supporters are saying quite openly, not only are they going to create a Xanadu effect within the West Wing of the White House, but they're going to, you know, purge all of the civil service of, you know, career employees of the federal government and replace them with Trump loyalists so that the entire government is going to operate in a, you know, within that land of Xanadu, that made up false reality that Trump himself wants to live in. I mean, that does not bode well for anyone's future.
No, and we can already see it, you know, a microcosm of it in the Republican National Committee. They're you know, defenestrating scores of people who were there and putting in Trump loyalists, including his daughter-in-law as the number two person, to maintain Xanadu at GOP headquarters. Chris Christie, who's, of course, an acerbic critic of Trump and who knows Trump from the inside, says that you'll have a White House full of, quote, deranged sycophants under Trump. So bad as it is under Biden, it's bound to be worse. This endemic problem of the presidency will be worse under Trump. And Trump is actually, not only is he going to put the government into Xanadu, he sort of put his voters there too, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're all in this fictive world that he's created, where the deep state, without evidence, subverted his election, where, you know, fascists and communists needed to be rooted out of the woodwork, where the immigrants are poisoning the blood. He's taken them into this delusion as well.
Yeah. Okay, so you've given us today's question for our Jack Potter's listening. Folks, I want to know, first of all, do you think it is possible for anyone who becomes president of the United States to resist the Xanadu effect, as Jack has named it? So first of all, that, and if so, how? And I'm also curious about whether in your own lives, either you or someone you know, was sort of coddled against actual reality, and what it took to, you know, reconnect that person to the facts of their lives that perhaps they were resistant to. Because I think there's always something for us to learn by your individual life experiences. So let us know those things via the OnPoint Vox Pop app. Many of you already have it. Definitely tell your friends, your neighbors, your dog walker, whomever, that they should also download the OnPoint Vox Pop app as well. Anywhere where they get their apps, look for OnPoint Vox Pop and participate, as many of you do, in our weekly ongoing conversation with JackPod listeners. So with that in mind, Jack, when we come back in just a second here, we're going to hear what people had to say about your analysis, Jack, of President Biden's State of the Union address. So that's in a moment when we come back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
Okay, Jack, we are back, and let's dive right into what people thought of your analysis of Biden's State of the Union address. And we specifically had asked folks to share their thoughts on who we are as a country and who best reflects that vision. Was it in Biden's State of the Union, or was that vision in the Republican response? So let's start with Patty from Yellow Springs, Ohio.
I can't say who we are as a people, but no one demonstrates the nature of the Republican Party like the Republicans. The angry faces at the State of the Union address said it all, followed by the ridiculous, dramatic rebuttal from Katie Britt. God help us all.
Here's Susan. Now, she backed Nikki Haley in the Republican caucuses from Centerpoint, Iowa. And Jack, Susan says that she's looking for someone to speak to the grit and optimism that Americans should have about their democracy. But
when you look at the Republican Party in general, it is very disappointing that they seem to be more negative, more glass half empty, very much into blame, or it's someone else's fault. They're going to pass that buck on.
So, Jack, by the way, Susan also told us that over the years she's campaigned and voted for many Republicans, but she can no longer stand behind the party because she just thinks it's too full of doom and gloom. So I'm wondering what you think about her idea that we need candidates to speak to an optimistic democracy.
Yes. Hubert Humphrey in 1968, when everything was going to hell, and in the worst year of the Vietnam War, he talked about the politics of love. It did seem a little disjunct with the reality. But I take her point. First of all, she's a Nikki Haley supporter. Mm-hmm. Isn't it telling that I think I'm right with the figure? 77,000 Republicans at the Georgia primary this week voted uncommitted on wouldn't vote for Trump on that ballot. Either voted for Haley or didn't vote. 77,000 votes. Georgia was decided in 2020 by fewer than 12,000.
Wow,
that's a real wake up call for Donald Trump. But beyond that, the issue of optimism. There's that phrase from Gramsci, the Italian Marxist. We have to be pessimists of the intellect, optimists of the will. I think that really does catch it. How the hell can you avoid pessimism when you just look at the facts? On the other hand, how can you avoid the counter to that, which is, by God, we've got to change this. We've got to do better. And I think Susan points to that is alive in people. They want to hear not Xanadu optimism, but real optimism. Maybe even just pointing to the past. Look at the things that our, you know, our predecessors had to deal with. The Great Depression, the World War. So I take her point entirely. And as for Patty, yes. But, you know, it is the fact that half the country is reflected in the Republican, those grim Republican faces. And that is half the country. Her comment about Katie Britt, apparently the senator got wrong, seriously wrong, that terrible, gruesome anecdote about an undocumented person being serious, just awful.
Yes, this was an anecdote that Senator Britt brought in her Republican response about a sexual assault, which, given how she said it, implied happened under Joe Biden's watch, under the Biden administration's watch, but it actually happened like in the early 2000s and in Mexico, not even in the United States. So it actually had nothing to do with migration that's happening now. So that's just to clarify. But go on with your point about the importance of that.
That's a real problem. But and she was widely criticized for the, you know, high school play dramatic effects she did, and for speaking from the kitchen and so on. But, you know, David Brooks, who's kind of a professionally complacent man, but on the other hand, he has insights into America that few people do. He said about her performance, he said, you know, in a lot of the country, people don't, when they speak, they're not trying to show you how smart they are. They're just trying to say, here's what the way I look at things. He says, here on the coast, it's all, oh, I'm gonna come out with a zinger now. And he said, you know, I think Katie Britt is, that's the way a lot of Americans are. Not that that fake dramatic stuff, but that she's just speaking from her own experience. I thought that was an interesting point about class in America.
Yeah. Well, and also, again, media, coastal media, let's just kind of lump it all together that way, saw the Brit response in a certain way. But to add to what you're saying, David Brooks said, if there's anything that the Republican Party knows very, very well, it's their base. And I believe she absolutely hit the nail on the head for Republican voters in the base, in her tone, in what she said, how she said it, et cetera. So that is a fact that cannot be glossed over. But can I just go back to Susan for 1 second? Because she really, she really... sort of sung my song here with her comment, because to your point, Jack, yes, we have to be cognizant and accepting of reality as it is right now, both its good and bad aspects. But I think she's talking about something which is very American, and it's always inspired me. It's like we can then also be optimistic for what we want in the future. We have to have a vision. There's nothing wrong with it being, an optimistic one. And, we're missing that both from the doom and gloom right, but also the America is the source of all evil left, you know?
Indeed.
Right?
Indeed.
And so, I think her criticism is equally spread on both ends of the political spectrum here. But
yes, and it cuts against the dominant political culture of our past. You know, George Santayana said the only indigenous Native American religion is belief in the future, tomorrow. which is what she wants, an optimistic democracy.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for sending your thoughts. Do so again this week, because clearly you gave us a lot to think about. But we have other Jack Potters who need to have their say. And this is Howard. You know him as the man with the view from Elkhart, Indiana. And Howard wants everyone to know that he does not think that the Democratic or Republican parties represent who we are as a nation.
If only the other options to the two parties got the same media legitimacy, then we, the voters, would be able to vote for what we think is important to us, instead of being given the choice between these two and vote against the evil you dislike the most. It is impossible for only two parties to accurately represent the views of 300 plus million Americans. We could actually have a democratic republic if we got rid of the Electoral College and gave legitimacy to more than just the two parties. It is time for people to have the chance to vote for what they actually believe in instead of voting against what they disagree with.
Jack, over to you.
Well, Howard, as always, goes right to the root, you know, the two-party duopoly and how it limits and sort of cabins Americans into rival camps rather than having, you know, many voices heard. And he's right also about negative partisanship, or what they call effective polarization, where people hate both parties but hate one more than the other, and that's how they vote. And you could say that's the past that the two-party system has brought us to. But we all know how hard it is to break into to break that duopoly. Ralph Nader has built a career out of talking about its inadequacies just before he pretty much blew it up in 2000 by his quixotic and damaging presidential campaign. But there's no doubt we need parties that represent the country in its complexity. We don't have them.
Yeah. You know, Jack, senior editor Dori Scheimer and I are hatching a plan to get Howard on the show with you so we could just hear the two of you in conversation. All right, so let's head towards our last Jack Potter here. This is Joe, who's from Los Angeles. And I'm going to guess that if he were in the same room as actually Susan, our other listener we just heard from, he might have given Susan, let's call it a respectful side eye.
My answer to your question, who are we, is quite pessimistic. Americans are profoundly ignorant of their own country and much more so of the world around them. I believe American anti-intellectualism is such a broad and rich topic anymore that one could make an undergraduate major out of it. The natural consequence of ignorance is fear. Ignorance and fear will always win more elections than enlightenment and courage.
Jack, go ahead.
Oh, gosh. Joe really dishes it there. Perhaps, not always. It didn't do it. Well, you could say it maybe. I mean, Richard Nixon did not run, after all, in 1968 on, dividing the country. His mantra was, bring us together. It was George Wallace who was running on hate and division, and he did not win. You know, Joe's comment about the voters reminds me of the Adlai Stevenson anecdote. A lady came up to him and said, "Oh, Governor Stevenson, you are so urbane, so articulate. You're going to capture the vote of every thinking person in the United States." Stevenson said, "Madam, but I need a majority."
Sorry, Jack, I shouldn't have left about that. Oh, are you still there, Jack?
I'm here, yeah. Okay.
I'm so sorry. Wow. Okay. Let me just say to Joe that I totally understand why you are feeling so full of pessimism. However, again, hearkening back to Susan, we have a choice, right? We can choose to hope for a better tomorrow. And for as long as I walk this here Earth, Jack, I'm going to choose for to hope for a better tomorrow. Now, I do want to say that Joe, by the way, he's actually not all doom and gloom at all, because he left us another quick thought about something that he heard on the Jackpod last week. Do you remember when we played that tape from Chris from Arcata, California? Jack, because Chris had said that you're being too generous when talking about low information voters, and Chris said something to the effect of, "When are we going to start calling these people bleeping stupid?"
Yes.
You remember that? So then you and I kind of had this like interesting conversation, maybe saying, "Hey, yeah, Chris, like we kind of disagree." And so here's what Joe said when he heard that.
I want to thank you for including the comments of Chris in California in your show last week. While Chris was certainly preaching to this choir of one, your thoughtful responses did make me pause for a moment, something that is missing from most of our public discourse.
Jack, I think that is amongst the highest praise that we could receive, don't you?
That's very nice, Joe. I really appreciate that. I think in our back and forth, we did try to take the bark a little bit off Chris's dismissal of half the population as stupid, but without dipping into our own Xanadu.
Indeed, Jack. Well, Jack, thank you as always. This has been another remarkable Jackpod.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is the Jackpod from On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.